This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Ragged Dick, or Street Life in New York with the Bootblacks, by Horatio Alger, Jr. Chapter 17. Dick's First Appearance in Society. It was the hour for morning service. The boys followed Mr. Grayson into the handsome church and were assigned seats in his own pew. There were two persons already seated in it, a good-looking lady of middle age and a pretty little girl of 9. They were Mrs. Grayson and her only daughter, Ida. They looked pleasantly at the boys as they entered, smiling a welcome to them. The morning service commenced. It must be acknowledged that Dick felt rather awkward. It was an unusual place for him, and it need not be wondered at that he felt like a cat in a strange garret. He would not have known when to rise if he had not taken notice of what the rest of the audience did, and followed their example. He was sitting next to Ida, and as it was the first time he had ever been near so well-dressed a young lady, he naturally felt bashful. When the hymns were announced, Ida found the place, and offered a hymn book to our hero. Dick took it awkwardly, but his studies had not yet been pursued far enough for him to read the words readily. However, he resolved to keep up appearances, and kept his eyes fixed steadily on the hymn book. At length, the service was over. The people began to file slowly out of church, and among them, of course, Mr. Grayson's family and the two boys. It seemed very strange to Dick to find himself in such different companionship from which he had been accustomed, and he could not help thinking, "Wonder what Johnny Nolan would say if he could see me now." But Johnny's business engagements did not often summon him to Fifth Avenue, and Dick was not likely to be seen by any of his friends in the lower part of the city.
"We have our Sunday school in the afternoon," said Mr. Grayson. "I suppose you live at some distance from here?"
"In Mott Street, sir," answered Dick.
"That is too far to go and return. Suppose you and your friend come and dine with us, and then we can come here together in the afternoon."
Dick was as much astonished at this invitation as if he had really been invited by the mayor to dine with him and the board of aldermen. Mr. Grayson was evidently a rich man, and yet he had actually invited two bootblacks to dine with him.
I guess we'd better go home, sir," said Dick, hesitating.
"I don't think you can have many very pressing engagements to interfere with your accepting my invitation," said Mr. Grayson good-humoredly, for he understood the reason of Dick's hesitation. "So I take it for granted that you both accept."
Before Dick fairly knew what he intended to do, he was walking down Fifth Avenue with his new friends. Now, our young hero was not naturally bashful, but he certainly felt so now, especially as Miss Ida Grayson chose to walk by his side, leaving Henry Fosdick to walk with her father and mother.
"What is your name?" asked Ida pleasantly.
Our hero was about to answer Ragged Dick, when it occurred to him that in the present company he had better forget his old nickname. "Dick Hunter," he answered.
"Dick," repeated Ida, "that means Richard, doesn't it?"
"Everybody calls me Dick."
"I have a cousin, Dick," said the young lady sociably. "His name is Dick Wilson. I suppose you don't know him."
"No," said Dick.
"I like the name of Dick," said the young lady, with charming frankness.
Without being able to tell why, Dick felt rather glad she did. He plucked up the courage to ask her name.
"My name is Ida," answered the young lady. "Do you like it?"
"Yes," said Dick. "It's a bully name." Dick turned red as soon as he had said it, for he felt that he had not used the right expression. The little girl broke into a silvery laugh.
"What a funny boy you are!" she said.
I didn't mean it," said Dick, stammering. "I mean, it's a tip-top name." Here Ida laughed again, and Dick wished himself back in Mott Street.
"How old are you?"
inquired Ida, continuing her examination. "I'm 14, going on 15," said Dick.
"You're a big boy of your age," said Ida. "My cousin Dick is a year older than you, but he isn't as large."
Dick looked pleased. Boys generally like to be told that they are large of their age. "How old be you?" asked Dick, beginning to feel more at his ease.
"I'm 9 years old," said Ida. "I go to Miss Jarvis's school. I've just begun to learn French. Do you know French?
Not enough to hurt me, said Dick.
Ida laughed again, and told him that he was a droll boy.
Do you like it? Asked Dick.
I like it pretty well, except the verbs. I can't remember them well.
Do you go to school?
I'm studying with a private tutor, said Dick.
Are you? So is my cousin Dick. He's going to college this year. Are you going to college?
Not this year.
Because if you did, you know you'd be in the same class with my cousin. It would be funny to have two Dicks in one class.
They turned down 24th Street, passing the Fifth Avenue Hotel on the left, and stopped before an elegant house with a brown stone front. The bell was rung, and the door being opened, the boys, somewhat abashed, followed Mr. Grayson into a handsome hall. They were told where to hang their hats, and a moment afterwards were ushered into a comfortable dining room, where a table was spread for dinner. Dick took his seat on the edge of a sofa, and was tempted to rub his eyes to make sure that he was really awake. He could hardly believe that he was a guest in so fine a mansion. Ida helped to put the boys at their ease.
"Do you like pictures?" she asked.
"Very much," answered Henry. The little girl brought a book of handsome engravings, and seating herself beside Dick, to whom she seemed to have taken a decided fancy, commenced showing them to him.
"These are the pyramids of Egypt," she said, pointing to one engraving.
"What are they for?" asked Dick, puzzled. "I don't see any windows."
"No," said Ida, "I don't believe anybody lives there. Do they, Papa?"
"No, my dear. They were used for the burial of the dead. The largest of them is said to be the loftiest building in the world, with one exception. The spire of the Cathedral of Strasbourg is 24 feet higher, if I remember rightly."
"Is Egypt near here?" asked Dick.
"Oh, no, it's ever so many miles off, about 400 or 500. Didn't you know?"
"No," said Dick, "I never heard."
"You don't appear to be very accurate in your information, Ida," said her mother.
4 or 5,000 miles would be considerably nearer the truth." After a little more conversation, they sat down to dinner. Dick seated himself in an embarrassed way. He was very much afraid of doing or saying something which would be considered an impropriety, and had the uncomfortable feeling that everybody was looking at him and watching his behavior.
"Where do you live, Dick?"
asked Ida familiarly.
"In Mott Street." "Where is that?"
"More than a mile off."
"Is it a nice street?"
"Not very," said Dick. "Only poor folks live there."
"Are you poor?"
"Little girls should be seen and not heard," said her mother gently.
"If you are," said Ida, "I'll give you the $5 gold piece Aunt gave me for a birthday present."
"Dick cannot be called poor, my child," said Mrs. Grayson, "since he earns his living by his own exertions."
"Do you earn your living?"
asked Ida, who was a very inquisitive young lady, and not easily silenced.
"What do you do?"
Dick blushed violently. At such a table, and in the presence of the servant who was standing at that moment behind his chair, he did not like to say that he was a shoeblack, although he knew well that there was nothing dishonorable in the occupation. Mr. Grayson perceived his feelings, and to spare them, he said,
"You are too inquisitive, Ida. Sometime Dick may tell you, but you know we don't talk of business on Sundays."
Dick, in his embarrassment, had swallowed a large spoonful of hot soup, which made him turn red in the face. For the second time, in spite of the prospect of the best dinner he had ever eaten, he wished himself back in Mott Street. Henry Fosdick was more easy and unembarrassed than Dick, not having led such a vagabond and neglected life. But it was to Dick that Ida chiefly directed her conversation, having apparently taken a fancy to his frank and handsome face. I believe I have already said that Dick was a very good-looking boy, especially now since he kept his face clean. He had a frank, honest expression, which generally won its way to the favor of those with whom he came in contact. Dick got along pretty well at the table by dint of noticing how the rest acted, but there was one thing he could not manage, eating with his fork, which, by the way, he thought a very singular arrangement. At length they arose from the table, somewhat to Dick's relief. Again Ida devoted herself to the boys, and exhibited a profusely illustrated Bible for their entertainment. Dick was interested in looking at the pictures, though he knew very little of their subjects.
Henry Fosdick was much better informed, as might have been expected. When the boys were about to leave the house with Mr. Grayson for the Sunday school, Ida placed her hand in Dick's and said persuasively, "You'll come again, Dick, won't you?"
"Thank you," said Dick. "I'd like to."
And he could not help thinking Ida the nicest girl he had ever seen.
"Yes," said Mrs. Grayson hospitably. "We shall be glad to see you both here again."
"Thank you so much," said Henry Fosdick gratefully. "We should like very much to come."
I will not dwell upon the hour spent in Sunday school, nor upon the remarks of Mr. Grayson to his class. He found Dick's ignorance of religious subjects so great that he was obliged to begin at the beginning with him. Dick was interested in hearing the children sing, and readily promised to come again the next Sunday. When the service was over, Dick and Henry walked homewards. Dick could not help letting his thoughts rest on the sweet little girl who had given him so cordial a welcome, and hoping that he might meet her again.
"Mr. Grayson is a nice man, isn't he, Dick?" asked Henry, as they were turning into Mott Street and were already in sight of their lodging house.
"Ain't he, though?" said Dick. "He treated us just as if we were young gentlemen."
"Ida seemed to take a great fancy to you."
"She's a tip-top girl," said Dick, "but she asked so many questions that I didn't know what to say."
He had scarcely finished speaking when a stone whizzed by his head, and turning quickly he saw Mickey Maguire running around the corner of the street which they had just passed. End of chapter 17. Chapter 18. Mickey Maguire's Second Defeat. Dick was no coward, nor was he in the habit of submitting passively to an insult. When, therefore, he recognized Mickey as his assailant, he instantly turned and gave chase. Mickey anticipated pursuit and ran at his utmost speed. It is doubtful if Dick would have overtaken him, but Mickey had the ill luck to trip just as he had entered a narrow alley, and falling with some violence, received a sharp blow from the hard stones, which made him scream with pain.
"Ow!" he whined. "Don't you hit a feller when he's down!"
"What made you fire that stone at me?" demanded our hero, looking down at the fallen bully.
"Just for fun," said Mickey.
"It would have been a very agreeable surprise if it had hit me," said Dick. "Supposing I fire a rock at you just for fun?"
"Don't!" exclaimed Mickey in alarm.
"It seems you don't like agreeable surprises," said Dick, "any more than the man did what got hooked by a cow one morning before breakfast. It didn't improve his appetite much."
"I've most broke my arm," said Mickey, ruefully rubbing the affected limb.
"If it's broke, you can't fire no more stones, which is a very cheerin' reflection," said Dick.
"If you haven't money enough to buy a wooden one, I'll lend you a quarter. There's one good thing about wooden ones, they ain't liable to get cold in winter, which is another cheerin' reflection."
"I don't want none of your cheerin' reflections," said Mickey sullenly. "Your company ain't wanted here."
"Thank you for your polite invitation to leave," said Dick, bowing ceremoniously. "I'm willing to go, but if you throw more stones at me, Mickey Maguire, I'll hurt you worse than the stones did." The only answer made to this warning was a scowl from his fallen opponent. It was quite evident that Dick had the best of it, and he thought it prudent to say nothing.
"As I've got a friend waiting outside, I shall have to tear myself away," said Dick. "You'd better not throw any more stones, Mickey Maguire, for it don't seem to agree with your constitution." Mickey muttered something which Dick did not stay to hear. He backed out of the alley, keeping a watchful eye on his fallen foe, and rejoined Henry Fosdick, who was awaiting his return.
"Who was it, Dick?" he asked.
"A particular friend of mine, Mickey Maguire," said Dick. "He playfully fired a rock at my head as a mark of affection. He loves me like a brother, Mickey does."
"Rather a dangerous kind of a friend, I should think," said Fosdick. "He might have killed you."
"I've warned him not to be so affectionate another time," said Dick.
"I know him," said Henry Fosdick. "He's at the head of a gang of boys living at the Five Points. He threatened to whip me once because a gentleman employed me to black his boots instead of him."
"He's been at the island two or three times for stealing," said Dick.
"I guess he won't touch me again. He'd rather get hold of small boys. If he ever does anything to you, Fosdick, just let me know and I'll give him a thrashing."
Dick was right. Mickey Maguire was a bully, and and like most bullies, did not fancy tackling boys whose strength was equal or superior to his own. Although he hated Dick more than ever, because he thought our hero was putting on airs, he had too lively a remembrance of his strength and courage to venture upon another open attack. He contented himself, therefore, whenever he met Dick, with scowling at him. Dick took this very philosophically, remarking that if it was soothing to Mickey's feelings, he might as well go ahead, as it didn't hurt him much. It will not be necessary to chronicle the events of the next few weeks. A new life had commenced for Dick. He no longer haunted the gallery of the Old Bowery, and even Tony Pastor's hospitable doors had lost their old attractions. He spent 2 hours every evening in study. His progress was astonishingly rapid. He was gifted with a natural quickness, and he was stimulated by the desire to acquire a fair education as a means of growing up 'spectable, as he termed it. Much was due also to the patience and perseverance of Henry Fosdick, who made a capital teacher. "You're improving wonderfully, Dick," said his friend one evening, when Dick had read an entire paragraph without a mistake. "Am I?" said Dick, with satisfaction. "Yes, if you'll buy a writing book tomorrow, we can begin writing tomorrow evening." "What else do you know, Henry?" asked Dick. "Arithmetic and geography and grammar." "What a lot you know," said Dick admiringly. "I don't know any of them," said Fosdick. "I've only studied them. I wish I knew a great deal more." "I'll be satisfied when I know as much as you," said Dick. "It seems a great deal to you now, Dick, but in a few months you'll think differently. The more you know, the more you'll want to know."
"Then there ain't any end to learning?" said Dick.
"No."
"Well," said Dick, "I guess I'll be as much as 60 before I know everything."
"Yes, as old as that, probably," said Fosdick, laughing.
"Anyway, you know too much to be black in boots. Leave that to ignorant chaps like me."
"You won't be ignorant long, Dick. You ought to get into some office or counting room."
"I wish I could," said Fosdick earnestly. "I don't succeed very well at blacking boots. You make a great deal more than I do."
"That's 'cause I ain't troubled with bashfulness," said Dick. "Bashfulness ain't as natural to me as it is to you. I'm always on hand, as the cat said to the milk. You'd better give up shines, Fosdick, and give your attention to mercantile pursuits."
"I've thought of trying to get a place," said Fosdick, "but no one would take me with these clothes."
And he directed his glance to his well-worn suit, which he kept as neat as he could, but which, in spite of all of his care, began to show decided marks of use. There was also here and there a stain of blacking upon it, which, though an advertisement of his profession, scarcely added to its good appearance.
"I almost wanted to stay at home from Sunday school last Sunday," he continued, "because I thought everybody would notice how dirty and worn my clothes had got to be."
"If my clothes wasn't 2 sizes too big for you," said Dick generously, "I'd change. You'd look as if you'd got into your great-uncle's suit by mistake."
"You're very kind, Dick, to think of changing," said Fosdick, "for your suit is much better than mine. But I don't think that mine would suit you very well. The pants would show a little more of your ankles than is the fashion, and you couldn't eat a very hearty dinner without bursting the buttons off the vest."
"That wouldn't be very convenient," said Dick. "I ain't fond of lacing to show my elegant figure. But I say," he added, with a sudden thought, "how much money have we got in the savings bank?" Fosdick took a key from his pocket and went to the drawer in which the bank books were kept, and opening it brought them out for inspection. It was found that Dick had the sum of $18.90 placed to his credit, while Fosdick had $6.45. To explain the large difference, it must be remembered that Dick had deposited $5 before Henry deposited anything, being the amount he had received as a gift from Mr. Whitney.
"How much does that make, the lot of it?" asked Dick. "I ain't much on figures yet, you know."
"It makes $25.35, Dick," said his companion, who did not understand the thought which suggested the question.
"Take it and buy some clothes, Henry," said Dick shortly.
"What, your money too?"
"In course."
"No, Dick, you are too generous. I couldn't think of it. Almost 3/4 of the money is yours. You must spend it on yourself."
"I don't need it," said Dick.
"You may not need it now, but you will sometime."
"I shall have some more then.
"That may be, but it wouldn't be fair for me to use your money, Dick. I thank you all the same for your kindness."
"Well, I'll lend it to you then," persisted Dick, "and you can pay me when you get to be a rich merchant."
"But it isn't likely I ever shall be one."
"How do you know?"
"I went to a fortune teller once, and she told me that I was born under a lucky star with a hard name, and I should have a rich man for my particular friend who would make my fortune. I guess you are going to be the rich man."
Fosdick laughed, and steadily refused for some time to avail himself of Dick's generous proposal. But at length, perceiving that our hero seemed much disappointed, and would really be glad if his offer were accepted, he agreed to use as much as might be needful. This at once brought back Dick's good humor, and he entered with great enthusiasm into his friend's plans. The next day, they withdrew the money from the bank, and when business got a little slack, in the afternoon set out in search of a clothing store. Dick knew enough of the city to be able to find a place where a good bargain could be obtained. He was determined that Fosdick should have a good serviceable suit, even if it took all the money they had. The result of their search was that for $23, Fosdick obtained a very neat outfit, including a couple of shirts, a hat, and a pair of shoes, besides a dark mixed suit, which appeared stout and of good quality.
"Shall I send the bundle home?" asked the salesman, impressed by the offhand manner in which Dick drew out the money in payment for the clothes.
"Thank you," said Dick. "You're very kind, but I'll take it home myself, and you can allow me something for my trouble."
"All right," said the clerk, laughing. "I'll allow it on your next purchase."
Proceeding to their apartment in Mott Street, Fosdick at once tried on his new suit, and it was found to be an excellent fit. Dick surveyed his new friend with much satisfaction.
"You look like a young gentleman of fortune," he said, "and do credit to your governor."
"I suppose that means you, Dick," said Fosdick, laughing.
"In course it does."
"You should say, of course," said Fosdick, who, in virtue of his position as Dick's tutor, ventured to correct his language from time to time.
"How dare you correct your governor?" said Dick, with comic indignation. "I'll cut you off with a shilling, you young dog," as the Marquis said to his nephew in the play at the Old Bowery.
End of chapter 18.